You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiatakis. It was a disturbing morning in Hancock Park recently, as Mayor Eric Garcetti described it during a Zoom press conference on Friday.
Yesterday, I woke up, as too many Californians do, with somebody screaming outside my house, experiencing a mental health crisis, woke me up. And as I got dressed to go out and to talk to him, he ran off before I could get there.
Well, that was Garcetti speaking in support of a new proposal from California Governor Gavin Newsom, a proposal that's meant to alleviate the overlapping mental health and homelessness crises in cities such as Los Angeles. Here's the governor.
What's happening in this state is unacceptable. There's no compassion stepping over people in the streets and sidewalks. There's no compassion or reading about someone losing their life under 280 in an encampment. There's no compassion in that.
And Newsom says he wants to create a system that could place some folks with severe mental illness or substance use disorders under court-ordered care. He calls it Community Assistance, Recovery, and Empowerment, or CARE Court, C-A-R-E. But so far, it's pretty short on details. KCRW reporter Anna Scott covers homelessness, and she's here to talk about it right now. Hey, Anna.
Hey, Steve.
What do we know about this proposal, this CARE Court proposal?
Well, like you said, it is short on details. This is really just the sketchiest outline of a plan. It's not funded yet. There's no legislation written laying out exactly how it would work. Newsom is calling it a framework. So I think that's important to say right up front. But the basic idea is to create a new pathway inside the behavioral healthcare system that we have now that's somewhere in between a crisis intervention, like a short-term psychiatric hold, and a full-on conservatorship where somebody loses their legal decision-making rights indefinitely. It would be for people with severe mental illness or addiction, and not just people experiencing homelessness, by the way. And this is the idea of how it would work. A family member or a person working with somebody suffering from one of those diseases, like maybe a clinician or a first responder, could ask a judge to order a clinical assessment. And then based on that and whatever criteria they come up with, the court would order a 1 to 2 year treatment plan that might include medication or housing services. We don't yet know, though, what the diagnostic criteria would be for somebody to come under this program, and that is a huge question mark. And every county in California would have to participate in this.
Speak to the controversy about this, though. It is controversial, right?
Yeah, anything involving mandated psychiatric or psychological care is going to be controversial. The ACLU has already expressed concerns about this, but we don't have details. It's really early on. So if it moves forward, I wouldn't be surprised to see challenges, even maybe a lawsuit, but we just don't know yet because it's so new.
So how does the system work right now, Anna? If you have a family member who suffers from serious mental illness or maybe addiction, here in California, what can you do?
Your options are pretty limited. One person I spoke to about this is Sarah Dussault. She's the chair of the commission that oversees the LA Homeless Services Authority. And she also has a brother who suffers from severe mental illness, who has been in and out of homelessness for a long time. And even for someone with Sarah's resources and expertise, she says it's incredibly hard to find help.
One of the just heartbreaking parts about this is the way the system is set up now is that there's just this total isolation for somebody suffering from mental illness and total isolation from their family. And their family can try their hardest to be helpful and do what they can. But the way the system is currently designed, it's not helping enough people. And in particular, when somebody suffers a crisis event, there just isn't that access to follow-up care, and there's nobody assigned to track and make sure that it's actually happening.
So there are these gaping holes in the system right now, and that's what this proposal is trying to address.
Yeah, you can see it certainly on the streets of Los Angeles right now and in a lot of places.
Yeah, I also spoke with Dr. Susan Partovi, a physician who has had a long time street medicine practice, and she works with people experiencing homelessness. And she says that for people with disabling mental illness who can't take care of themselves, there are very few places where they can go simply to get stabilized, which often is ideally a first step to treatment.
not enough places to go. That's one reason the mental health system feeds into this homelessness crisis that we see. Could this proposal, Anna, improve the situation on the streets, do you think?
Maybe. I think that's the best I can say right now. According to the LA Homeless Services Authority, about a third of LA's homeless population deals with serious diagnosed mental illness or addiction. And remember, we still don't know the exact criteria for putting people under this care court system. So it could be more or less than that that would qualify. You know, at the same time, it could be something that's life-saving for some fraction of people experiencing homelessness who might otherwise die on the streets.
Yeah, I mean, walking or driving around LA, I mean, it seems like there's a major mental health crisis happening on the streets. And as you heard the mayor saying earlier, you can't help but think if we could solve the mental health portion of this, that crisis, couldn't we then solve the homelessness crisis?
Well, it's understandable to think that way and to ask that question, but it's also important to remember a few things. One is that there's a lot of homelessness that's not so visible, and most people experiencing homelessness don't have severe mental illness or addiction, according to LASA, and they wouldn't be affected by a program like this. And also, just because the gaps in the mental health care system are exacerbating LA's homelessness crisis, that doesn't mean that's what's driving it. Behind the crisis at large, there's still this broader lack of affordable housing all over LA County of all kinds. There's not enough permanent supportive housing. There's not enough board and care facilities. And there's not enough just cheap apartments. Here's Sarah Dussault again.
I think that for this type of initiative to be successful, we need to see more housing units.
Now, she did add that if this proposal, however it takes shape, could provide care for people who are really ill and unsheltered, it could possibly free up resources like outreach, case management, shelter beds for other unhoused people who don't have these acute issues. So it could possibly also help people get off the streets in that way.
How far away, Anna, is this plan from becoming reality, by the way?
It's pretty far away at this point, although Newsom says that he would like to move quickly and is working on legislation with lawmakers that could make it concrete. Then, though, it would need to be funded. Newsom himself said it could cost billions of dollars to set up the infrastructure for this, to hire the necessary people. So there's a lot that still has to be worked out, and we'll keep following it.
All right. We'll see if anything happens fast enough, maybe to be reflected in this year's budget, too, that comes out in June. KCRW's Anna Scott, who covers homelessness and housing. Anna, thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Moving on now with KCRW's Greater LA, I'm Steve Chiotakis. It was another weekend of protests across SoCal over the Russian invasion of Ukraine. That was the crowd gathered in Venice yesterday, one of the many gatherings across LA, Westminster, Laguna Beach, and all around the world. And those protests come as the violence in Ukraine is going on its third week. Hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians are leaving their country and traveling west to safety, while others are sheltering in place or trying to just get out of cities. Among them is the family of Nika Belska. She lives here in Los Angeles with her Ukrainian husband, who also has family back home. Hey, Nika.
Hello.
And joining us also is Olga Grigoryants, who is a reporter for the Los Angeles Daily News. She is Russian. She has a family that remains in Russia. Hi, Olga.
Hi, Steve.
Nika, I want to start with you. First and foremost, how is your family doing back home?
It's a hard question. Everyone is stressed out, of course, and trying to do what they can. My family is in the capital, and now they're in the sort of cottage house just outside of the capital, sheltering in place, and trying to help with local volunteers, which basically everyone turned into either volunteers or local, you know, defense patrols, sort of. So my family is still there. My husband's family is in the south. They were just shelling them this whole night and the city called Mykolaiv. And my husband's both parents are doctors. His father is a surgeon, and he hasn't been at home for the last 3 days. And before that, he only once came home since February 24th, because he's getting so many injured soldiers that he has to stay in the hospital and keep putting people back together. And his mom is an OB-GYN. She works in the labor centers. They mostly stay like in the sort of underground floor where all the pregnant women were moved to be safer.
Olga, you have family and friends in Russia right now, some of them very close to the border with Ukraine. What are you hearing from them? And what are they saying about this invasion?
Well, I have a lot of friends in Russia, especially in Moscow. And that's right, as you said, I have relatives in the western part of the country, close to the Ukrainian border. And when the invasion happened, I was up all night just checking on them. And one of my relatives told me that her house was shaking that night on February 24 when the invasion started. The windows in her house were shaking, and it was quite terrifying. She saw military planes flying by. But since then, it's been quiet. And I have to say, well, it is what it is. So all of my relatives on that side of the country, they support Putin. And they see what's happening there. And unfortunately, yeah, they just support whatever is happening in Ukraine, because they feel it's Russia has been attacked by the West. And they all tell me that this war is not about Ukraine. This war is about United States, and Russia is just pushing against NATO and its expansion, you know, towards Russia.
And you said this is a proxy. Ukraine is just a proxy for the United States. This is the U.S. This is NATO expansion. This is a threat to Russia. Has that ideology been there for a long time, or is this something new?
That concern has been there for a while, and I think especially after the invasion of Ukraine, that's the message that, well, one of the reasons why many Russians supported annexation of Crimea is because they believe that Russia really had to make that move, because there is a military base, a Russian military base in Crimea. And they believe that in order to, you know, kind of take Crimea back. And I believe Khrushchev allowed Ukraine to join Crimea to join Ukraine in the 70s. And they believe that it was just fair to take that part of the country back, because it historically belonged to Russia. That's how, you know, a lot of people believe. And they just started feeling more and more threat, you know, since then, since 2014. They just felt like, you know, NATO and the U.S. are getting more and more aggressive. I mean, that's based on the propaganda, obviously, that Russians see. But that's the kind of major belief. And I hear that a lot from my friends and relatives who just say, this war is not about Ukraine, it's about the U.S. And you have to understand that, you know, one of my friends told me yesterday, she said, the whole world turned its back on us, and we're just going to be isolated. And this is exactly what the U.S. wants for Russia.
Nika, when you hear what Olga is saying, what goes through your mind?
That's exactly why Russia should be isolated from the whole world, because they nurtured and grew up a monster for 30 years after the Soviet Union fell apart. They were nurturing this ideology and like eating all this propaganda, and that's where it led them. But now Ukrainians are suffering, like millions of people have to hide, have to leave their houses, have to be under shellings, have to lose their kids and their husbands. The families are being separated. It's not a joke. Ukrainians are a very hardworking nation. It's been under Russian attacks for hundreds of years. And every time they fight back. But this time, we were building this country separately and, you know, restoring our culture while after Soviet Union suppression for 30 years. And Ukraine is a great country. We have so many startups, so much, you know, science ongoing and like a lot of going on. And just by, in one night, by one, you know, monster, let's call it that, everything is ruined. And I have no compassion, like 0% compassion to Russians, because they were living there and supporting that. Ukrainians had their revolution. We had a monster and we kicked him out. He is in Russia. And Russians should do the same. There are like 140 million people. They don't have so many army to kill them all. They should just do what they did in 1991. Kick out the Soviet Union. That's it. Because now the whole world is suffering and Ukraine the most. And we're like life shield in front of Europe and no one is doing anything.
Olga, what's it like being in Los Angeles and a journalist yourself, hearing what your family is hearing and what they're saying to you and the propaganda that they're getting and the lack of any kind of, you know, diverse knowledge about what's going on?
Well, I have to tell you, it's very devastating. And there's a lot of shame. There's a lot of guilt. There's a lot of frustration. There's a lot of fear about the future of my country, future of Ukraine. And it's a little bit difficult for me to talk about Russia and Ukraine, you know, the war about the two countries, because as somebody just told me, it seems like every Russian family has a grandma in Ukraine. And it's totally true. They're not just, you know, their family ties, their economic, cultural, linguistic, religious ties between the two countries, but they're also family ties that are impossible to break. I can't even explain, you know, it's devastating to know that there's a war anywhere in the world, and knowing that your people can support a war, especially as devastating as the one that is happening right now in Ukraine. It's just sad. It's just extremely, extremely sad. I just, you know, there's another aspect of it. I realized that Russia is quickly turning into this state where people just afraid to say anything. People are afraid to express their opinion. And to be honest with you, I'm a little bit careful about what I'm telling my, you know, friends and relatives. And I don't know if anybody's tracking our conversations, because there are a lot of conversations now in Russia that messages are being checked and tracked. And so I don't want them to get in trouble, you know, for talking to me or anybody who, you know, who's in the West. So I'm trying to be mindful of that and careful, and at the same time, just learning their position. And honestly, even since the Ukrainian invasion, I see how opinions have shifted. I see how opinions shifted among my friends and relatives. So I'm hopeful. And I hope that, if somebody just told me, you know, from the local community, there's a truth, you know, we know what's right. And we know that sooner or later, everybody would understand what's really going on right now in Ukraine. Hopefully it will happen sooner rather than later.
I want to wish you both the best. And Nika, I sure hope your family is okay. And your husband, Sergey, I hope his family is okay. And Olga, yours too. Olga Grigoryants, reporter for the LA Daily News. Nika Belska, a Ukrainian national living here in Los Angeles. Thanks to you both.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Todd Spitzer has gone from running a re-election campaign to now fending off calls for his resignation in Orange County. Spitzer, the OC district attorney, is accused of using racist language during discussion of a murder case involving a black defendant. And there's video that surfaced of him using the N-word over and over again in a speech that he made to an OC group. Gustavo Arellano is a columnist for the LA Times. He joins us as usual to talk about it. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
So two different issues here concerning Spitzer, both of them involving allegations of racism. I want to take them one by one. First, the comments that he made about black men dating white women. Tell us what he said and the circumstances of what he said.
So this was a meeting that happened last fall, a Spitzer with some of the members of his office in the district attorney's office. And they were discussing a murder case involving a black man who had murdered two white people. And all we know about this meeting came from a memo by then prosecutor Ebrahim Beitia, who he said that in the context, in the conversation that was going on with Spitzer, that Spitzer said, well, you know, in some cases, black men date white women to, quote, get themselves out of their bad circumstances and bad situations. And that everyone at that meeting was like, what are you talking about, Todd? You shouldn't be talking about things like that. But that Todd doubled down and said, no, this is pertinent to this particular case. So this happened back in October, but all of this came to light when a memo that Beitia released in February made all those allegations. But by then, Beitia had already been fired by Spitzer.
Do we know why he was fired by Spitzer?
Well, Todd says, oh, this was involving Beitia's conduct in the case from years ago, going back to the regime of Tony Rakakis, the previous Orange County District Attorney. Here's the thing with Beitia. Todd Spitzer at one point called him his North Star. Like, this is the guy who I want as, like, my philosophical, the man who's going to show me the way. But after, you know, recently, Todd has maligned Beitia as part of the Tony Rakakis regime of just lies and all of this stuff. So Todd tried to have it both ways, and now look where he's at.
And by the way, we should say that Spitzer apologized. He told the LA Times that Beitia misquoted him. And he actually described black men's motivation in dating white women as improving their stature in the community, which doesn't sound much better, to be quite honest. Yeah, that's
Todd for you.
All right, issue number two. This is a video where Spitzer says the N-word multiple times. Tell us what was going on there.
So this was video that was filmed during a 2019 banquet for a group of Persian lawyers, Iranian-American lawyers in Orange County. And Todd was talking about hate crimes. And Todd is very upfront saying, I cannot stand hate crimes. I'm going to push. So he was talking about a specific incident about a white supremacist who had beat up a black woman. And Todd was quoting him. And, if you're a white supremacist, you're going to say the N-word multiple times. So video just emerged because this is a, you know, election season. And so people are telling Todd, like, you can't say the N-word as a white man. And Todd was saying, look, I was just saying it in the context of the conversation. And me personally, as someone who has covered hate crimes in Orange County, I could sympathize with and understand what Todd was going through. But at the same time, Todd, you can't say that word anymore and not expect people to get very upset at you.
And Spitzer says he's quoting what this white supremacist said, using the N-word over and over again.
Yeah, no, and again, I understand where that's coming from. A lot of times when you cover hate crime, some people would argue you should know how ugly the hate is. But at the same time, it's in the wake of 2020 and the country's ongoing conversations about a racial reckoning. You just can't say that word as a white man anymore.
He's also, Gustavo, being accused of trying to cover these situations up, though, right? Like, is this akin to that old saying, you know, it's not the crime, it's the cover-up?
So this is another memo filed by someone from the Newport Beach Police Department, a lieutenant, I believe, alleging that Todd was trying to cover his tracks about saying these words, this description of black men, and that imperiled the future of the case, which used to be a death penalty case. And now the Newport Beach lieutenant and also a lot of Spitzer's critics are saying, like, no, now you're not going to be able to get the death penalty in this because the defense attorney could easily go and say there's bias in this case.
Spitzer is in the middle of a re-election campaign against the former Marine Corps judge advocate Pete Hardin. What does the Hardin campaign say about all? I mean, I can imagine what they're saying, right?
Oh, yeah. Resign, yeah. Todd. Todd Spitzer's a racist. We cannot have someone like Todd Spitzer be the district attorney in Orange County. Vote Pete Hardin. So now it's, you know, piñata season against Todd all over Orange County.
I mentioned there have been some calls for him to resign. I mean, obviously, Pete Hardin has called for him to resign. What do you think happens next?
Oh, then the ACP in California has asked him to resign. A lot of district attorneys, Republican district attorneys, mind you, have pulled their endorsement of Todd. Todd's not going anywhere. At the end, it's going to be up to the voters in June to decide whether they want to go with Todd or Pete. And this is Orange County. Anywhere else you have a district attorney going through these allegations of racism the way Todd Spitzer is doing, he would either resign or show more penance. But that's not the way Todd Spitzer goes. And by the way, Orange County, we're still Orange County.
Gustavo Arellano, columnist of the LA Times, and every week he joins us for KCRW's Orange County Line. Gustavo, thanks.
Gracias.
And that's all the time we have for today. Tomorrow, we're 2 years on from COVID taking full root in LA. And it's still going, but some folks who got it are dealing with what they call long COVID, those serious health effects that go on for months and months. That's tomorrow on this program. Visit us online anytime at kcrw.com/GLA. What stories would you like to hear? What's on your mind? It's at kcrw.com/GLA, and get the podcast while you're there. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Andrea Bautista, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Amy Ta, Holly Adams, and Christian Bordahl all made this evening's show happen. I'm Steve Chitakis. Thanks for your time and attention tonight. Have yourself a great night.